small finance teams can be given big budgets for tech and stay lean. Big finance teams can be given really small budgets for tech, you know, so they've no option but to use, say, 50 plus spreadsheets, for example. I think benchmarking is a tricky one. From my perspective, is instead of benchmarking, asking the question, are we adding the value that we need to add? Because it's pointless benchmarking yourself against another organization who's got all of this whizzy tech, all of these FP&A tools, you know, all of this level of automation. But you don't know whether that level of automation and all the whizzy tech is actually making them a better finance team as a result.
So welcome to It's Not All About the Numbers, the leadership podcast that doesn't just focus on the bottom line. My name is Chris and that is Mike.
Hi, everyone.
And today we have a fantastic co-host, a real trailblazer in the AI finance space, Adam Shilton, founder of Tech for Finance. Hi, Adam.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's jump straight in. As I said, if you do like what we're doing, then do hit subscribe on your preferred podcast provider and hit those 5 stars because it all helps our motivation and the algorithms. And we'll start with, how's your week been? Mike, I'll let you go first.
Cheers, Chris. So this week after our adventures in Southampton last week has been a week at home. I've been doing lots of reading about agri-tech in the UK for a project that I'm working on. So I'm kind of getting my head around autonomous vehicles, drones, self-driving tractors, all that kind of stuff. That's quite exciting. We had the Generation CFO Mastermind on Tuesday that you and I did, Chris, and we talked about the change curve, and I managed to keep you from exploding, which I thought was quite a result.
Yes, controversial content.
It was controversial. Happy outcome, right? Everyone was happy at the end. And then my final bit is I've just found out that next weekend I'm off to Ethiopia for a week of project work. So that's going to be interesting as well. So lots of stuff going on.
Wow, what a week. So driverless tractors, Ethiopia, and
it's crazy, man.
Change.
That's
you right there, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm not sure, but I think that the most exciting thing is just going back to the coffee in Ethiopia and getting back into some traditional Ethiopian coffee.
Excellent. I hear it's good, but I imagine it's even better straight from the shop.
It's ridiculous. Yes.
Is it? Okay. No. Well, please bring some back. And, you know, if you can deliveroo it, then that'll be amazing too.
Deliveroo.
How was your week, Adam? Off to Africa? Anywhere nice?
No. I've got 2 young kids.
Ah.
We're going to Crete in June, beginning of June. And that'll be the first time that we've been abroad for 3.5 years.
Wow, overdue.
Yeah, we've not been out of the country since Isaac was born. So yeah, that'll be nice. But no, I've not been gallivanting anywhere.
How young are the kids?
Isaac's was 3 in October. And Roman is 19, coming up to 20 months.
Okay.
So yeah, they don't sleep.
I was waiting for you to say months there because I thought, wow, there's a story.
still counting in months means they're young, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I could just say almost two. That would be the easiest thing, wouldn't it?
And speaking from experience, you know, I'm sure it's been well overdue, but you don't want to be getting on a plane with very young babies. It's, people don't like you. And the longer the flight, the less they like you. So, yeah, all good.
It's amazing the logistics that you have to think about because it's 4-hour flight, 4.5 hours or whatever it is. But then you always forget about the transfer from the airport to the resort. And if we'd flown into one side of the island, it would have been another 3 hours worth of transfer to the resort. So we had to change airports for 30-minute transfer. But I think we're going to have to reshuffle it because Roman is huge now. And if they're still classed as a toddler, then they don't technically need their own seat. They sit on a parent's lap. I'm telling you now, he will not do that. So I think we need to change the booking. Anyway.
I love the name, Huge Roman. I've got Russell Crowe and Gladiator in my head for some reason. Anyway, moving on. So yeah, my week, had fun. Went to a quiz night for the school. Got some tips in there actually for our next away day, Mike. We had to build a giraffe out of paper and sellotape. So that was great. I was a bit annoyed though, because they didn't include that in the overall result of the quiz, which put a lot of effort into that. But I think we came fourth, which is not too good. I think we normally come first or second. But anyway, just a bit of fun, not too competitive. The other thing on the personal side, again, just to sort of recharge the batteries, I have started to talk about open water swimming. But it is still February and it is still freezing out there. So I think the earliest I've started is April. But who knows? I'll keep you posted on that.
Is that like when I talk about doing the London Marathon and know that I never will, absolutely never will? It's all talk. Are you going to do it?
Hey, look, I used to open water swim. I even used to do the odd triathlon. That was a long time ago. But no, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's just, you know, it was like 3 degrees. The water was 3 degrees. Like, who gets in that water? A group of people that I found. But, you know, it's crazy. Anyway, and yeah, had on the work front, did our Gen CFO talks, which was great. Had a really good chat with a couple of leaders who were automating their month end and successfully managing a lot of change there, which was really interesting to hear from, particularly Mark Skinner, who is sort of director of accounting operations, I think he is, Immerstad. Really hands-on leader there, great guy actually. And the last thing was we announced that we're going to New York City. Oh, yeah, for a in May for a Gen CFO meet. So that's super fun. Because a bit like you, Adam, I haven't been overseas for quite a while. And you know, a bit of travel like that will be fantastic. So busy weeks for all of us. Really, really good to hear. So looking at what's happening in the news, what's happened this week. So Mike, I know that you want me to stop talking about generative AI, but it's, I don't know whether it's going to happen soon. Gen AI battle continues. And a month ago, Microsoft added Copilot to basically everything and made it available to everyone after it being kind of phased through their MVPs for quite a while. But now Google have relaunched Bard as Gemini. And I just wanted to sort of have a bit of a chat about this, because they've relaunched Gemini, I think because they are looking to sort of get rid of Bard's bad press. From, he had quite a lot of performance criticism. It's actually a bigger offer, the Gemini now. It's looking to try and compete with ChatGPT and the like, the premium offers that they have. But I was just wondering, you know, your take. And Adam, I know this is a bit of a sweet spot for you. You know, what's your take on the Gemini other than the Bard?
So I didn't want to like it because I hated Bard so much.
Yeah.
And I had high hopes for Bard, because all of the personal stuff, all of the tech finance stuff is done in Google Workspace. Yeah. So I'd be amazing if I had like an AI assistant that was plugged into my workspace, because similar to the ChatGPT plugins, they said, "Oh, right, well, we're going to enable you to extend Bard to connect to Gmail and Google Drive and all of that sort of stuff. And it can help you recall files and, you know, check your emails and all that sort of stuff." So, oh, that's amazing. And it was really rubbish. So it was, yeah, I spent more time trying to get it to find the right files than the amount of clicks that I would have had to do just to find the file myself. So, you know, it was useless in my mind.
Yeah.
And then Gemini came about, which originally was just another model before they rebranded Bard to Gemini. And then I recently did a comparison of loads of large language models. because I've got nothing better to do. So obviously the OpenAI models, the new Gemini model, some of the open source ones. So your Mixtrals from Mistral and Llama, which is the Meta model and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then also a comparison of the free versus the paid models, because I think that's what most people want to know is, you know, am I going to get better results if I pay for something versus just using the free stuff?
Yeah.
It's not just about results, it's about data as well, because quite often you can only protect your data if you pay for the service, right? You know, and even with some of the paid models, your data is still not protected. So you pay for ChatGPT Pro, it's still used to train the model. Only when you move on to the team version of ChatGPT that your data is then not used to train the model. So you've got to go up two levels to protect your data with ChatGPT now, or go into the enterprise version, which is probably sickeningly expensive, but I don't know because I don't know what the price is. But either way,
you're exciting Mike here as Mr. IP.
So there were a couple of interesting things, and I will get back onto talking about Gemini in a second. But one of the interesting things was, obviously, Microsoft have a really close relationship with OpenAI, and they've used the OpenAI models to power Copilot, not just Copilot in Microsoft Office, you know, the big, you know, announcement that we had recently, but just their online sort of standalone AI chat, which was Bing Chat, which has now been branded to just Copilot. Again, horribly confusing, not well marketed for Microsoft at all. But if you go to copilot.microsoft.com and just log in with your Microsoft account, whether it's a personal or a business one, your data is protected. It's not used to train the model, but you get OpenAI's most advanced models without having to pay for them. So I recently have been using Copilot more because I know that my data is safer on that platform. The only things that you don't get with Copilot is like the plugins, the GPTs, and all of that sort of stuff that you get from ChatGPT, right? So there are trade-offs.
So Copilot in Bing or just Copilot in the Microsoft suite?
It's not Bing anymore. They've just rebranded it from Bing Chat to Copilot. Yeah, so...
Okay, but your point of access is through Edge and browser or through the Microsoft tools?
Do it anywhere.
Anywhere, okay.
So it's built into Edge now. So there's a Copilot icon on the top right that to pop out. Yeah. As I say, you can just go to the URL, which is copilot.microsoft.com or any browser, you know, so you can do that in Edge, Google Chrome or whatever. So that's pretty cool. So anybody that wants access to more powerful models for free can just use Copilot now, which is good.
Yeah.
I don't know where the money is from Microsoft on that, because it probably costs them quite a lot to use the OpenAI API to facilitate that service. But as I say,
I'll just take you back though, because obviously there's been a lot of sort of changes happening, and I think, you know, what we talk about a lot here is about how you communicate and how you take people on a change and how you transform. And you just mentioned something there about, you know, I didn't want to like it, but I ended up liking it. And then equally, I never used Bing in the past because I didn't like it. So just putting Bing Chat was like, I don't want to move to it. Mm-hmm. But then you rebrand and it becomes something different. Mm-hmm. You know, what was behind that change for you?
Before you go there, can I just make a suggestion? Because I hadn't twigged this until you started talking about it a minute or two ago. Yeah. But if you say Gemini, it sounds quite a lot like Gen AI.
Yes.
So in terms of a cute bit of branding, it might not be a bad idea when you're asking, doing voice searches for things, if you brand your model with something that's easily confusable with the generic term. I mean, maybe that's me being suspicious.
So are you saying that they're training all of the language models to hear Gen AI as Gemini? So they get all of the traffic.
I think it links to the point that you were making though, Adam, around Bard, the initial experiences with Bard were bad. So the reputation of Bard became bad. So actually a rebrand is a relaunch, therefore it's now good. Similarly, exactly what you just said about Bing, right? So Bing has been relaunched because its reputation was bad. Mm-hmm. So,
what's the change message here? You know, what's the change sort of learning? You can relaunch things by changing the name. Yeah, I mean, like associating this to a transformation project, right? If it's going badly, if you move it from Project Mike to Project Chris, or the other way around. Project Chris to Project Mike. Well, you know, is that enough to actually move the goalpost to reinvent it?
So I was going to say, I think if the product changes, then yes. So if that change is accompanied by a step change in performance or quality or blah, 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 then yes. If it's simply a rebrand in terms of it's the same stuff repackaged with a different logo, then no.
Yeah. You don't want to put lipstick on a pig. So
that's a much better way of putting it. Thank you.
If you there's the soundbite. Yeah, in fact, that's the title of this one.
If you want to rebrand, then you've got to make sure that you're either delivering more value or making something easier to use. Yeah, and I think in the Bing to Copilot rebrand, even though it's technically still called Bing Search, just the AI engine is now called Copilot instead of Bing Chat, they've given a more intelligent model and they've made it easier to access because it's built into everywhere that you can use Microsoft. It's even built into the latest Windows operating systems now. There's a Copilot icon in the bottom right of my computer as I'm looking at the screen now. So yeah, I think they've done well. I don't think they've done a good job because I've only really heard the people like me talking about like using Copilot as opposed to ChatGPT. Do you see what I mean? So I think Microsoft still have some things to do to differentiate the Copilot AI chat to the Copilot in Office. But historically, Microsoft have always been really bad at marketing the differences between their solutions. But technically, there's a Copilot for security, there's a Copilot for Power Automate, there's a Copilot for blah, 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 blah. Do you see what I mean? But people don't know because it's so confusing.
Yeah. That was a lovely segue, actually, because you just talked about, you know, people talking about this stuff, and you are talking about this stuff. I've been super impressed by, you know, everything that you're doing on your own podcast, but also your communication on this. I think it's brilliant. And something that Mike talks about quite a lot is this sort of almost like the translator role, where you got to take something technical and turn it into plain English. And you seem to really nail that. You know, tell us a bit more about what you do and how you do it.
So it starts on my understanding, you know, and as with many things, you know, I think in my personal scenario, it started with fear. You know, maybe this is me being a little bit too honest, but when ChatGPT first got released back into 2022, I was initially terrified. And it was because I was scared that I spent so much time investigating it. But then that fear turned into understanding. And me translating it into a format that I understood, you know, I might as well have started talking about it online, which I did. And that's how it all evolved, right? But the difficulty I've got at the moment is the pace. So I've not been doing as much of the how-to stuff recently, because as soon as you release a how-to one model or one tool or whatever, you've then got to record another how-to the next day on the next iteration that's been released. So yeah, that's one of the permanent battles, is deciding what the time span is to revisit something. Because going back to that large language model comparison that I mentioned, I could do that once a week and spend several hours a week with the rate of change at the moment. So I think the trick at the moment is, right, well, is it once a month? Is it once a quarter? I've still not decided on the cadence yet, but yeah, it's being a translator is great and I love doing it. Don't get me wrong. But it does come with quite a lot of fatigue.
That makes sense. I recognize some of what you've just described there. I just want to go back to the fear statement that you made. What was it fear of? Fear of not understanding, fear of being replaced, fear of something else, 1984?
Well, I overthink everything. So my background is a sales background. I'm very, very vocal about that, very vocal about the fact that I still have a day job, as many people do. And it's one of those where, and it wasn't necessarily the replacement that concerned me. It was more the, how far is this going to go? Because I don't really want to get to the point where an AI tells me what to do as opposed to a person. And there's two ways of cutting it, and we don't need to get too deep on all of that sort of stuff. But you know, there's one train of thought that says, right, well, it's always going to be the people that are programming the AI, you know, but what if it's the AI that ends up programming the people? And as I say, we're getting a bit deep here, and, you know, for a Friday afternoon, maybe it needs to be a little bit more lighthearted, but you hear what I'm saying, right? You know, Sam Altman, OpenAI, you know, he's said quite vocally that the only goal he has is creating artificial general intelligence, which is, you know, basically an AI person, right? So yeah, that was the initial fear. And then, you know, young kids, like, how do I teach my kids what is fact from fiction? You know, with all the deep fakes and that sort of stuff, how do they know what they're watching is real versus what is false? And with all the OpenAI, what's it called? Is it Sora, S-O-R-A, that they've released now, which is Sora. The, like...
Well, it's been released to a group of sort of super users, I think, and the messaging's pretty sort of clear on it. You know, we're trying this out, and we are trying to release it responsibly. And yeah, but I think, you know, I think a lot of people were the same, right? When all this stuff came out, it's the fear of the unknown. And then there's a concern about what it means to people and the impact on their careers and stuff like that. And, you know, everyone's on a journey, right, with this, and you're really helping kind of take people on that journey. But coming back to your journey, right? And you mentioned that you've got a day job now, and you're a consultant. But before then, you started your sort of journey in music production, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a very different, well, maybe in, from the outside of looking in, that is a very different interest to where you are today. Mm-hmm. So how did you go from there to helping finance leaders? And are there any sort of lessons in there that help you with your messaging now?
So I was having to think about this recently, and I've given all sorts of different answers on all this sorts of different podcasts, and, you know, being very transparent, sometimes you don't always know where something comes from, and you don't always know what your story is, because in reality, I could probably tell 10 different stories about how I ended up where I am right now. So it's a very difficult question to answer. But I did the thing of, and I'm not really a pen and paper sort of person. I'm more of a, you know, type it type journal person. Not that I really do much journaling anymore, but I was trying to go a step further than the music, because the music started because I didn't really have a place at school. I wasn't really a popular kid. I didn't really have a group, but I loved playing instruments. And as soon as people recognized that I had a talent, they wanted to spend time with me. Yeah, so they saw, oh, you know, Adam Shithot guitar, you know, we need to form a band with him. It immediately meant that I had more friends. Do you know what I mean? You know, instead of me playing guitar on my own, I had friends, I played in bands, I was the cool kid, you know. So I went from that nerdy, not having a place with the oversized shoes and the baggy blazer that didn't fit, to the dude that had long hair, you know, started working out, you know, was headbanging on stage and all of that sort of stuff. And it was great to get that recognition. But if I go a step further than that and think about what I did as a kid, I spent my life trying to pinch my dad's old work laptops. You know, I've never spoken about this sort of stuff before, but I remember the first time we got a desktop computer in the house, you couldn't get me off of it. You know, and there was this game, and I think it was called Populous, the beginning. And it was a game where you create your own world. So you start in the Dark Ages, and then obviously you teach your little tribe how to do that. And it was one of those evolution games where you ended up in sort of, you know, a classical stage, and then you'd move into the different phases or whatever. And I loved that sort of stuff. And then obviously computers to laptops, all of those sorts of stuff. I remember the first time I saw a spreadsheet on a computer, like, it blew my mind. I mean, I was only really young at the time, right? And then a word processor. I remember going to my friend's house. His dad worked for Microsoft.
Yeah.
That was probably the first computer I saw. And he, like, opened a document, started typing on the keyboard, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. You see what I mean? So
this is the world before Minecraft, right? It did exist.
Yeah.
And your young kids will be getting into Minecraft soon. I think it's the most popular game in the world.
Yeah. Absolutely. So the kind of computers came first, and I remember, like, you know, I used to love it when Microsoft released a new operating system. Like, remember Windows XP, which was the most drastic update because the bar at the bottom turned blue and green. You know, and you had that really high contrast rolling green hill background as the default background in the back, didn't you? Yeah. So that was, you know, I'd sometimes just log into the computer to look at what was in the utilities and what you got with the new operating system that you didn't go with the last one. It sounds really sad talking about it out loud, but that's what it was, right? Music production is still systems, right? Because whether using Pro Tools, Logic, you know, it's all tech that you use to sort of weave the different channels of audio together, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. And then when you look at some of the stuff that I do at the moment, it's like no code tools. It's like, you know, all of the really cool apps that you can build stuff with, you know, and, you know, if money was no object, you know, I'd probably learn to code properly, build apps, you know, and spend my life in, you know, no code automation platforms. Do you see what I mean? So don't get me wrong. The music is a passion. And obviously I learned a lot about communication, about bringing people together and all of that sort of stuff.
You're almost, I don't know whether you're doing it intentionally, but you almost sort of painting this scene of you as, you know, AI producer in your studio with this sound deck in front of you, but it just happens to be all of those elements of, you know, AI and tech for finance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you're dialing up each one and you're dialing down each one, you know, and you're trying to sort of present this coherent message to people. So I can see the link, actually.
Yeah, I mean, my take on that, I'm thinking of something that I was thinking of as normal, thinking of two things. So the first thing is we interviewed Matt Buck from Drawnalism way back when. We had a conversation with him, and what I really liked about talking to him was the how he takes when we talk and turns it visual. So I like what Chris just did there, and I can see a great picture of you in this kind of studio, exactly as Chris said. But the other thing that Matt said when talking to him was that when he heard Chris and I talking about how we got to where we got to, he heard Chris talking about having a plan and following a plan, and he heard me talking about following my nose and seeing what the open doors are, what I like doing, and ending up there. And it sounds a bit what you're describing is you've got this broad skill set of that comes from understanding the technology, that what you're learning from the music production, you can apply to your role now in different ways. It's not like a direct line silo topic. It's like, it's almost like magpie-esque, right? I'm taking all of these great bits from around the place and bringing it all together to be a great communicator in this particular space. And I think it sounds fantastic, sounds amazing.
But I don't think in visuals. So it's interesting that you put that slant on it, Chris, because, yeah, I mean, some people, when they think about new things, will immediately go to pen and paper and start drawing shapes. Like for me, it's bullet point lists or spreadsheets, you know. Yeah. So, but everybody's different, right?
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I'm a visual learner, and but I think, you know, you are a great communicator, and I think there is, you know, if everybody was a great communicator, transformation and change and implementation of technology would happen a lot better, right? Mm. Because half the battle is laying out the strategy, the vision, the use case. In fact, arguably most of the battle is that, you know, to get people on side. I'm just curious, like, how did you develop that skill? Because you really do seem to have a great structure to your comms, you know, a bit of a magic power, I would say. You know, how did you learn that? Or did you just sort of trial and error it and see what worked?
So that's a really interesting question, and one that I haven't given a ton of thought to. So I've always listened and watched people. So I've always listened to podcasts, which is one of the reasons why I started my own podcast, because I enjoyed listening to them. I thought, I want to do that myself. So I think that helps, you know, absorbing the way that other people communicate. I think that was a really good foundation. I think if you've got a background in sales, you've no option but to find a way of communicating a point concisely, because otherwise you're not going to win the deal, right?
It's the elevator pitch.
Yeah, that's it. You know, if you can't tell the story and you can't hit the right points, you know, because, you know, you don't sell software with features and benefits anymore. You know, you sell software with outcomes, you know, and if your narrative doesn't match the outcomes, it's exactly the same whether I'm selling a software system to a CFO or whether a CFO is selling you know, either a strategy or something internally. It's exactly the same, right? You've just got to match your communication with the outcome that the individual you're speaking to is trying to achieve. That's what it comes about. But something's come to me that I'd almost forgotten about. And actually, it's interesting, Mike, because you mentioned you'd been doing a bit of work in agritech. So I did a bit of that in one of my jobs. I took basically poultry shed information from this massive site in Peru and amalgamated it into a Power BI dashboard so we could drive insight from it, essentially. But before that, I was in the energy space. So it was data visualization of large sites that had really, really high energy consumption. Yeah. So whether that was a local council, whereby they wanted to see whether a homeless person had slept in a toilet and kept the hand dryer on all night, because that was a spike in the data,
right?
Or whether it was a university campus that had noticed that a groundskeeper had left the floodlights on all night because they needed to do the rounds or whatever. But I remember my boss at the time, a dude called David Speller, I think he's still in the energy space. The company's called Digital Energy. I don't know whether it's still called that or not. But we went to a conference, and it was one of the first that I'd ever been to. Richard Hipkiss, not David Speller. David Speller was Optifarm. Richard Hipkiss was Digital Energy. And Richard had developed a bit of a name in the energy space for giving good presentations, being like the expert when it came to energy management. And he'd prepped this presentation. You know, I was supporting him because we were sponsoring the event as well. And then half an hour before the speech, he said, "Have you ever done any public speaking before?" And I said,
"Love it."
"Not really, Richard, no." And he said, "Right, well, you're up." He said, "You're going to take this."
Wow.
And he could have quite easily done it himself, but he had kind of that fiendish, you know, sort of schoolboy, you know, I'm going to wind you up, going to drop this on you. But I'm so glad that he did it, because within 30 minutes, I had to put something together. You know, and it was only a small group, you know, got a little bit of a round of applause at the end or whatever. But I guess that was the first environment where I've been thrown into a really uncomfortable situation where I had no option but to do a decent job, because the reputation of the company was at stake, right? So yes, I think a combination of me listening to good communicators and being thrown in at the deep end is probably what's got me where I am.
I'm just thinking about how he taught his kids to swim. And whether he's the kind of guy that just pushed him in the swimming pool.
Yeah, 3 degree cold water.
Yeah, exactly. So you clearly enjoy what you do. I just was curious, if you could distill it right down, what's the best thing about what it is that you do, the work that you do?
Oh.
Sorry.
I think it's that element of creation. And I mean that separately to being a creator. Yeah, so obviously creator is a term, you know, influencer, all of that sort of stuff. I don't consider myself a mega influencer. You know, I've not got, you know, anywhere near the following in some of the mega influencers. But essentially a creator is somebody who produces content in some format or whatever, you know. And I personally think everybody should and has the capacity to be a creator. But when I say creation, I mean in terms of building. You know, so using the low-code tools as an example, Mate.com, Zapier, you know, all sorts of similar type platforms, you can go from having no process to saving yourself an hour or two within the space of half an hour just by fitting the jigsaw pieces together. And then if you take that a step further and think a step up from no-code and start looking at code, because of course AI can help you code now, you can build something from nothing to facilitate a certain outcome. So right now, and I'm sure it will change, but right now, that's what brings me the most joy, is the solving a problem, starting from scratch, and yeah, figuring out how to do it, essentially. You know,
a born transformer, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And just so people know, Make.com is a sort of workflow automation tool, right, where you can automate a process and any process. Sure, they've heard, and many others that apply. Excellent, really good to hear all that. I do want to ask. So at this point, we tend to answer a question related to or something that's come in from our network. And I found one this week from our Lunch and Learn, which I think is probably an opportunity for you to talk a bit more about what you do and on the work side as well. The question was, how do we benchmark our own organization's level of finance tech maturity? And I think people are sort of, you know, curious about what other people have, but they don't have any sort of benchmarking references. They're only Googling stuff and seeing lots of tools. And there are a ton of tools out there. You know, you've alluded to this. So when you start looking, it's a bit overwhelming. So, you know, what's your take on benchmarking and getting a sense of tech maturity? And just so that you know, when we were on the talks yesterday, I think it was something like 70 or 80% of people still weren't even on the cloud for their ERPs or accounting systems. So I feel like there's a long way to go, you know, for most people. What do you think?
I have a feeling I know who asked that question. You don't have to say who it was, but I think we have a connection in common there because they asked me a similar thing in another community.
Small world.
Yes. I think it's an incredibly difficult question down to the variance in the way that businesses work and even in the way that finance teams work within a business. Yeah, because small finance teams can be given big budgets for tech and stay lean. Yeah. Like big finance teams can be given really small budgets for tech, you know, so they've no option but to use, say, 50 plus spreadsheets, for example. Yeah. So I think benchmarking is a tricky one. I think from my perspective, and maybe it's only a half answer, is instead of benchmarking, asking the question, are we adding the value that we need to add?
Yeah.
Because it's pointless benchmarking yourself against another organization who's got all of this WYSI tech, all of these FP&A tools, you know, all of this level of automation. But you don't know whether that level of automation and all the WYSI tech is actually making them a better finance team as a result.
Yeah.
And so for me, at a base level, you need to make sure that there's some sort of core finance system and ERP. Yeah, I think finance teams with any level of maturity, if they are still using, you know, Sage 50, QuickBooks, Xero plus spreadsheets as a base application, especially if there's any complexity there, it's not going to scale. So I think there needs to be some consideration in terms of an SME finance platform. And there's a ton. It doesn't necessarily mean move, you know, to like NetSuite or SAP or Sage Intacct straight away, but a cloud financial platform that's going to do the procure to pay, you know, it's going to do the OCR invoice capture, it's going to do all of the stuff that is a baseline for what's now expected in 2024. So I think that's foundational. I think you've then got to have a tool to make sense of your data, because finance systems, and some of them do have an element of, I guess, analytics and BI built into them, but essentially that base level is the operational foundation. Yeah.
You know? And you don't mean plus Excel plus Copilot.
No, that's it. If you want to use that, fill your boots, right? I'm sure people are not going to stop using Excel after I say what I've said.
Yeah.
But yeah, some sort of analytics platform, whether it's, you know, a Power BI or a Tableau or, you know, those sorts of things, because you need to be able to pull out that insight that you wouldn't be able to gain just by looking at operational data. You know, and the question that people need to ask themselves there when it comes to data is, what do I need to see that I can't see already? And the trick there is not just looking at the data that you already have, because when you ask that question, what decisions do we need to be able to make? What can we not see that we want to be able to see? You may need to revisit your process to start building that data entry in at the ground level, because you can't work on data that doesn't exist in the first place. Yeah. So asking that question and working back is better. So foundational finance system or ERP plus some sort of BI tool or business intelligence tool on top of that, I'd say is ground zero, right? And then depending on your complexity, you can decide whether you want some of the WYSI FP&A stuff. You know, some of the business intelligence tools do extend to FP&A, you know, and don't have time to list all of them, right? But that's when you start getting into your forecasting, your scenario planning and all of that sort of stuff. There are entry-level ways that you can do it manually, you know, and I know the likes of Christian Martinez, Nicolas Boucher, they talk about using like Google Colab and Python to do those predictive analytics and that sort of stuff. So, you know, if you're budget conscious, there are manual workarounds of doing that. But yeah. Again, you just got to make sure that you're solving for the right problems. So I'd say more often than not, an established modern finance team will have that baseline in place.
It's a really interesting point there. And I think you answered that really well, considering you did not see that question before the BOD. I think, you know, just to broaden it out a little bit, though, it's almost like there's something here. People are asking, what's my tech maturity? Mm-hmm. But actually, I think you were saying, look, you know, here's a stab at the tech maturity answer. But actually, what's your, you know, strategy maturity? You know, what's your sort of use case and outcome maturity? What's your KPI and decision-making maturity? Because that drives the rest of it, right?
And that might. Yeah, no, absolutely. I just wanted to jump in because I think that the thing that's there for me is around literacy. So by going down the road of saying something maturity, it means you can even have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think there's actually a problem around people's technological maturity. Literacy. So do they actually understand what it is that they're talking about? Mm-hmm. So yeah. I have to admit, in some of the things that you were saying there, I went whoa over my head, and which is good, right? Because I'm not in your space, so that's fine. But people expect there to be black box answers to some of these questions, and I think part of the problem, and you really hit on it, was we need to have that technological literacy. We need to have a language that's common that people understand. But it does come back to something that you said earlier, which is the problem solving. Let's know what the questions are that we're asking. Let's make sure the questions we're asking are good questions, and then people can help us solve those problems. Mm-hmm. Let's not leap to we need to understand what the technological solution is. Let's work out what the questions are we're answering. And I think that's the first step to technical to maturity, is that we even understand what it is that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's the same in data. And, you know, I've worked in data maturity for ages, and it's the same point.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna move us on, because I think we've answered that question thoroughly, actually. That was really good. And again, well done for covering that off, considering we threw that one at you. If you do want to ask a question at this point in the podcast, then do send your questions into podcast@generationcfo.com or send them to Mike and myself via LinkedIn. So next up, we've got our good data, bad data, as usual. This is just a chance to go through a few things that have tickled our fancy when it comes to use of data. Mike, I've seen something here about Tidycal. It sounds like a sort of diet app.
Well, kind of. So I've got, as people have probably picked up, I've got multiple projects at the moment with multiple organizations, which equals multiple diaries and multiple calendars. And I finally succumbed to getting a calendar help. I saw an ad for Tidycal. It seemed cheap. I've bought it. It's absolutely excellent because I can just ping links to people and people can book things into my calendar without me even having to faff around and do anything.
Calendar, not calorie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, okay. It could be. I mean, maybe that's another opportunity. So that's been really good data this week. I've already used it a few times, and it's. I mean, I've even sent Kira, who helps arrange these podcasts, a link to help arrange podcast sessions. So brilliant. Really like it.
Yeah, we should show our work a little bit. There's quite a lot of effort that goes into the podcast, and yeah, well done, Kira, for managing a lot of the ops around this as well. Good stuff. And I didn't actually have any good data on this this week. And I have to keep on really trying to find the good data. And for some reason, maybe it's just the world of social media, it always pushes me the negative data first. But the bad data, I love this visualization that you found. It's kind of like a process flow. And this doesn't work very well on podcasts, but we're still doing it. but Mike, the problem with plastics.
Yeah, so it's another sort of tip of the hat to Information is Beautiful, the website, and there's a visualization that I've seen around like plastics, basically. So for people that can't see the visualization, and I will share it afterwards in LinkedIn, so you should be able to find it. 8.3 billion tons of plastics have been produced ever, of which 31% is still in use, which is good news, but 59%, so 4.9 billion tons of plastic have been discarded, often after a single use. And it's just to sort of give an idea of the scale of the problem that we've got around plastics and use of plastics. And the really scary thing in all of that is probably when I was a kid, so probably before you were born, Adam, but when I was a kid, there was no plastic water bottles, there were no plastic bags, you know, everything was paper. It just wasn't the same. So yeah, in a very short period of time, we have produced a lot of single-use plastic and got rid of it.
You know what I found interesting in this one, though, is that it clearly shows that the route from purchase to, you know, bin, and the first step is splitting it in between single use and still in use, right? And the single use, there's a lot of the single use that is actually recycled. And I wonder whether there's a sort of psyche around this where we see certain single use plastics as unrecyclable. So therefore they must go into the bin, and they must go into, because it's a very small number that's currently recycled, right? 6% of that single use plastic is recycled.
I think this is the whole podcast in and of itself, right? In terms of the psychology of recycling, and whether it's the hierarchy of reduce, reuse, recycle, which is recycle is the last one. Reduce is the primary way of doing it. So I there's lots in there. It is surprising how little gets recycled, though. I agree. 6% is the number that's on this infographic.
Adam, anything on that? You worked in the agri space as well, so that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I'd say, when we're talking about Copilot earlier, where I mentioned the increased value and then whether it's easier to do, I think I don't really have many comments on the data. It's just a personal anecdote that says, I still don't think it's easy to find ways to recycle in some instances. So there's two stories. So one is, a couple of weeks ago, put my recycling out, they refused to collect it. Now, I'd not done anything different. Yeah, so they've been collecting the same combination of recycling for the past 2 years or however long I've been in the house. But for whatever reason, they decided, oh, no, not collecting that this day. So, and a lot of people wouldn't have done what I did when I took it all out of the bin, recategorized it, took it up the dump, put it in all of the various places, right? A lot of people think, right, well, they've not collected it. I can't be asked to go up the tip. So I'm just going to put it in a big black bag and throw it in the rubbish, right? So that's one piece where I don't think systems help. The other piece is when you're out and about. So I still think more often than not, travel to a lot of cities, it's just general waste in a lot of instances. Like the amount of times that I'll see a split bin that says plastics, cardboards, or whatever is 1 in 10. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, I appreciate it's bad data and it's a cause for concern, but I don't see a lot of help in making that process easier.
So I absolutely agree with that. I think that there was something in the news the other day about finally in one local authority, you can recycle glass. You can put your glass in with your plastics and your stuff and it all gets separated out at a recycling facility. I mean, so what was happening to the glass before that change was made? It's just like there should be a common way of doing this. So yeah, I agree. And even in where there are bins that are split when you're out and about, people don't use them properly anyway.
Yeah, good stuff. So, yeah, there is one more bit of bad data.
I was going to say, we should finish with good data, isn't it? Because this is always a down a bit.
Hey, it's the reality check. You know, change is hard. And, yeah, we will come on to Football Australia's data breach next time, because there's far too much good, bad data, sorry, going around on this podcast. But yeah, thank you for that. It was really interesting and loads of good stuff in there, actually, Adam. And I love the fact that you are clearly communicating a lot of this change and keep going with it, because it sounds like it's a lot of effort goes in. The pace of change is phenomenal. But even those high level messages, you know, are valuable to the audience. You know, where can our listeners sort of connect with you? And maybe this is a plug for your pod as well, because your podcast is going great guns.
That's it. Just find me on LinkedIn. So my handle across most socials is just Adam Shilton Tech. So Shilton Tech. Or just search Adam Shilton on LinkedIn and I should pop up. Tech for Finance, as in FOR instead of the number, is the podcast. So check that out there. And connect, drop me a message. We can have a chat.
Excellent. Well, best of luck with everything that you're doing. Sounds like you're juggling a lot of things at the moment. And most of all, enjoy that plane ride with your two young kids. Prepare for that.
Yes.
No, as long as it doesn't ruin the week in the middle, then we're all good.
Just think about how excited they're going to be, how easy it is for them to chill out whilst on the plane. Yeah.
Exactly. No, but thank you very much for your time today. That's thanks from me. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, everyone.
Perfect. Thanks. Excellent. See you later.
And remember, it's not all about the numbers.